Welcome to this week's Deep Dive with the Tenpenny Premium Files. Today we're having a conversation with Dr. Richard Fleming. Richard and I had a conversation back in December of 2020 about his research into developing a protocol for very ill patients who were hospitalized with COVID. You can listen to that important information here on the Tenpenny Files or on disseminate.tv. But after that interview, I got a few comments and some feedback from some listeners that wasn't entirely favorable regarding Dr. Richard's past medical career and some things that he had been through. But knowing how the system works and what the system did, for example, to Dr. Andy Wakefield, and more recently what they are trying to do to Dr. Paul Thomas, I knew that something was probably not exactly right about what had made it into the public eye. So I contacted Dr. Richard myself and I said, you know, what's your side of the story about this? And what he told me was both fascinating, disturbing, and not entirely surprising. So I wanted to do a full interview with him so that the rest of you could hear the story of his truth, what he's been through, what he was up against, and what actually happened when all he was really trying to do was to take the best care of his patients that he possibly could. So Richard, we've got about an hour, a little bit more than an hour, for you to tell your side of the story. But I'd like for you to begin with our members as to tell them a short version of your background, because we could take most of the whole hour hearing of all the things that you've done. I have read through most of your books, so I have a pretty good understanding about what we're going to talk about. But if you could give them a little bit of a background for those who don't know you, and then share with us, you know, your story, starting with how this whole fiasco began.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you first for the opportunity. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk about it. I think that's one of the ways in which you can tell whether somebody is really the good guy or the bad guy, is whether they want to talk about it or not. I mean, it's certainly not something I want to bring up at every conversational dinner party. But it is something that's important for people to know, because it really kind of lays out what type of world that we live in. I grew up in the state of Iowa, basically what you probably would consider a farming community. I come from farm family. I come from people that are very ethical. I consider myself very ethical, which is part of how I got to where I ended up at. I was blessed to have some advanced education beginning in seventh grade, thanks to the JFK administration. And so I started my doctorate training in physics. My area of interest was particle, but it was physics. Even in seventh grade, and by the time we had completed 12th grade, we had also completed our doctorate level, and whatever we had, mine was physics. When I got into medical school, one of the first things our dean told us is that 90% of what we do in medicine is wrong. We just don't know what that is. And there's two aspects to that. Some of it is because we don't know any better. And some of it, as I have unfortunately found out in my life, is because they do know better, but it's not financially rewarding for the powers that be. And there's very vested interests. So after going through medical school, internship, residency, I started my fellowship in cardiology in 1989 to 1992. And that was kind of a golden era for nuclear imaging and cardiology, because the brand new isotopes or radioactive compounds were research drugs. And in fact, I had the privilege of doing research and writing the first SPECT paper, which is a type of nuclear camera, on one of those compounds. I wrote the first one that was published, and it was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Now, at that point in time, I was taught that where we only used one dose of thallium of the isotope, we had to use two doses of these technetium compounds. We had to give one after we stressed the person. We had to do another one after they had recovered or at rest. So that was the party line. And I told everybody the same party line that I just mentioned, because that's what I was taught. And that's what I wrote in the JACC paper. When I started my own private practice, which was about my personal one in 1999, the pharmaceutical company came up to me and said, you know, Dr. Fleming, could you help us out? We want to get this same isotope used for breast cancer imaging, and the doctors here in the community won't do it. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, because people are getting various results that don't seem to match. And I said, well, you don't know. So, okay, let me see if I can figure out a way to do it. Because I'm a cardiologist, yes, my license allowed me to do imaging. because I had that type of training. Let's see if we can figure out a way to do it. And I came back to them several weeks later and I said, okay, if I can find women with breast cancer and heart disease that we need to image, I will set up something so that we don't have to give them more radiation. We'll give them just the two doses and we'll see the results. And what I learned from that was part of what helped me develop the patent, but I learned something else. I learned that the isotope didn't need to have two doses given. The party line is that you had to have two doses because the isotope went in and stuck. It didn't move around, and that's called redistribution. So they said it doesn't redistribute. You have to buy two doses. You have to give them two doses of radiation. When I did the breast cancer images, the breast cancer images also showed the heart. And then when I did the standard 1 hour image, I saw a new image of the heart that was different than 5 minutes, but there was only one dose of the isotope. And as I looked at that and I started calibrating the camera and making the camera accurate to measure, what I discovered was that the pharmaceutical company lied. Now I know they lied because I brought it to their attention. I said, do you see what I see? The counts are different. This isn't, you don't need two doses. No. You have to give two doses. And so I had a very good technologist, nuclear technologist at the time, who was behind me 100%, but unfortunately he had a skydiving accident and broke his legs, and I ended up picking up a new nuclear tech. And she got in touch with people in the government to say, Dr. Fleming is billing wrong because he's only giving one dose of radiation and he's billing for two sets of studies. That was the primary case, billing fraud for billing incorrectly because I only used one dose of radiation, and she said I couldn't possibly get two different images. Now, I tried to get those images presented at trial to show that they were different. The public defender refused to do that.
So wait, stop just a second. The time sequence between the first and the second image was how long?
Right. So initially what you would do if you wanted to do cardiac images, the way they sold it was you stressed them, gave an injection, and 1 hour later you would image the heart. And then you would wait for 4 hours and give them another injection and image the heart. But when I did the breast cancer imaging and combined it with the heart, I injected them right away after they got stressed and I imaged the breast at 5 minutes. And then I did my typical 1 hour image. And I compared those, and they were different. In fact, they were so different that people with critical heart disease could only be found if you did that five-minute image. You did not need a second injection, and you didn't need to wait 4 hours. So what did that mean? It mean that I found that you only needed one injection. For the pharmaceutical company, requiring two injections meant that they made $20 billion in extra sales in 2 decades. They exposed people to 3 million extra curies of radiation, which is a third of what shut down that Japanese reactor a decade ago. And because they didn't agree with taking that 5 minute image where the critical heart disease shows up, 100,000 Americans a year are told they don't have heart disease when they have critical disease, which means the test misses their disease and they die.
Wow.
Right. Right. All because they came to me and said, Dr. Fleming, could you find a way of getting breast cancer imaging worked into this? Otherwise, I wouldn't have found this. I had no reason to look at 5 minutes. Now, since then, other people have also shown that images at 5 and 6 minutes compared to an hour are different, and that the isotope redistributes. And I've gone to the effort of taking this to the FDA. And the FDA said, well, the company says that now the isotope kind of does redistribute and move around, and it's up to doctors how they want to do this, okay? So the billing fraud was because the images could not have possibly have been different, and we could not possibly have found heart disease in the five minutes that wasn't there at 1 hour, and that is exactly wrong. So that chewed up a lot of the trial, and I tried to get billing experts. I brought to my public defender the medical guideline, it's called the R5 manual, it's part of what I sent you, that says, if you do the images the way I did them, there's only one way to legally bill, which happens to be the way I billed. It is also exactly what I said in the plea agreement, that I did these two sets of images and billed in this way, which is the way the federal government says you have to bill legally. And if you don't bill that way, then you're illegally billing. They didn't present the American Medical Association documents that said, Dr. Fleming, not only did you not overbill, you underbilled. You could have billed for these other things that you didn't bill. You know, basically, what's wrong with you, doctor? You could have billed for more, right? They didn't present the University of Nebraska or University of Nevada Reno billing expert for the university who said, Dr. Fleming billed exactly correctly. In fact, their own expert got on the witness stand and started to say, I billed incorrectly. And I had to point to the public defender and say, look, right here in this email in front of you that I'm putting in front of you, this same witness sent me an email stating that I billed correctly. So,
did that piece get entered into evidence?
That last piece got presented, and the judge said, well, I guess there can be difference of opinions, you know, because they're experts saying one thing on the stand, on the trial, and something else in documents. And she looked at it and she went, well, okay. But the AMA documents didn't get presented. The billing expert from the university didn't get presented. The R5 documents didn't get presented. The federal case that had already been heard in Nevada, which is USB Prabhu, where a physician had been accused of billing fraud, where the federal judge there said, if a physician bills the way the government says to bill, you cannot convict them of billing fraud. So in my brain right now, as I'm talking to you, what I admitted to in the plea deal was not a crime.
I just wanted just to make sure that our listeners and our members really understand what you're saying. Just to make sure that I clarified it, and I want to clarify it for our members who are listening, is that the normal way that you would have done this without the breast imaging portion, that you would do a stress test, and you would inject a dye, and you would read a scan, and then 4 hours later you would inject another dye and take a scan.
Right,
and then compare the results of those scans one against the
right, two. Right.
But when you did the first, when people did the first stress test and you injected the first isotope, you didn't read it at 5 minutes. It was what, an hour later?
You were told you had to wait an hour because it took that long for it to show up.
I see. So what you did instead on your new study with the breast cancer thing is that you gave the isotope and took the reading right away.
You had to at 5 minutes for the breast.
Right. And oh, by the way, because the breast kind of sit next to the heart, you were able to see at 5 minutes.
The heart.
And then you scanned 4 hours later without adding another isotope?
No. Then I scanned at 1 hour like we were supposed to, which is when it's supposed to first show up. And the images were different.
I see.
Well, they can't be different according to the
company. All right, so let me restate this because this is really important to get because it's so important with your case, right? With your whole case, is that the normal way of doing it is that you give the isotope, you do a stress test, you do the bicycle or treadmill, you do the stress test, you inject the dye, take a reading an hour later because that's how long it's supposed to take to get into the muscle and all those things.
Then
4 hours later, you would give another dose and wait another hour and do that roughly and then compare the two.
Yep.
Now, because they had come to you and said, hey, we want to see if the active breast cancer actually takes up this isotope. So you said, okay, well, let's look at the heart and the breast at the same time. So you gave the isotope, but you had to do it within 5 minutes to take a look at the breast. And, oh, by the way, the heart just happens to be sitting there. So we see what happens. Well, we gave the normal thing we would do would be to do a reading in an hour because that would be the distribution. So you took another scan in an hour and you compared the 5 minutes to 1 hour and saw a big difference.
Yeah.
And so you were trying to then say to cardiology, the American Academy, you know, the Medical Association, all these different things. Hey, we can see what we really need to see in terms of diagnosing heart disease without two doses of radiation. And we're seeing more severe disease if we do it at 5 minutes. So we're saving a lot of lives.
Yeah.
But instead of getting, you know, the Nobel Prize for this, you got slapped with a fraudulent billing because you were doing, instead of giving that second dose in 4 hours, you did the two readings on one dose, and some billing clerk somewhere said you were doing two readings on one dose, and so therefore that's fraud.
Yeah, my nuclear tech. And what I discovered later is that my nuclear tech wore a wire in with the FBI outside of our offices, listening to everything I was saying on more than one occasion. And this is still all they came up with. And I say it that way because I have lots of friends in medicine that have told me, oh my, have they worn a billing, you know, a wire into their offices? They would discover lots of things. Now, that doesn't make me feel good because it's like, well, what are you guys doing that you shouldn't be doing? Don't do that. You know, just do what you're supposed to do. Okay?
So do you think hypothetically or maybe realistically,
right.
He was being paid off by the pharmaceutical industry to shut that down because they were going to lose half of their revenues if they did it your way?
Well, this was only the first half of the case. But yes, she got paid, I'm sure, as a witness.
I see.
The second half of the case was a soy chip study from somebody I knew who was involved in my ex-wife's breast cancer that we used the soy chip products to try to deal with breast cancer. Okay.
And you, what are soy chip products?
Soy chips, just a soy chip food product. Okay. And what happened was they got together with Avon to say if they wanted me to do a study where I took 60 women and instead of one of their meals a day, replaced it with some soy chips that was given to the women to eat. So you eat this instead of what you would normally eat, and see if they lose weight, okay? So I did that with 60 women, and the second charge, mail fraud, was that there weren't 60 women there. Now, they could never tell me how many they thought there were that were real versus non, but there were 60 women there. And the public defender was determined to prove to me that I was guilty of that charge. And so he was not helping at all. And so I found a statistician at Iowa State University, Dr. Alicia Kirikwe, who's one of the best in the country, if not the world, and has shown that the FBI's, some of the FBI cases were incorrect. So I got Alicia Kirikwe to develop a statistical test to determine whether my data on the 60 women was valid, was real. They made up a test from scratch, and they told me this later, Dr. Fleming, we think you are guilty, and we wrote a test to prove you were guilty. This is a statistical test. When they ran the statistical test, they went, oh my God, this data is real. Now, my public defender, to prove to me that he was smarter than me, gave them another set of data to determine if they could prove whether it was fake or not. And he said, look, this data I'm giving you, which I'm going to tell you what it's called. It's called the Hansen data. That's his last name, is faked data. They ran an analysis on his data and they said, we can't tell really what's wrong with this data because it has similarities to real data. However, if it was patterned after the Fleming data, that would explain it because that means it's not fake. It's plagiarized. And plagiarized data follows real data. So it looks like real data. So this public defender got really stressed out because the Office of Research Integrity that I sent the data to said, Fleming, we don't know what the government's coming after you for. The analysis by Dr. Kirikwe is exactly like it should be. And she says your data is valid. Okay, so what happens? They have two prosecutors, one for the billing and one for the soy chip study. At the soy chip trial, the report from Kirikwe is shown. Hansen's name is removed. Why is Hansen's name removed? Because Hansen, the public defender, told Kirikori, the statistician, take his name out of it. So the federal government found the first study, the first analysis that was called the Kaiser, and Kaiser was the person who worked with her, Kirikori. Well, it was the Kaiser report, where he had Hansen's name in it and made the comment about Hansen's data looks like, you know, if it was patterned after the Fleming data, that's what's going on. But what my public defender presented at trial was just the second report, the Kirikori report, where Hansen's name was taken out of it. The prosecutors got that and started presenting that, and Hansen started sweating. And the judge called a bench discussion where he decided that Kirikori was dishonest because she removed Hansen's name from the data. Remember, Hansen's the one who told her to. Hansen didn't admit that. And the judge says, well, they can't figure out that it's not valid. And Hansen said, well, that's the thing, Your Honor. It really isn't fake. I really patterned it after the Fleming data. And the judge said, the jury doesn't need to know the whole truth. The wool can be pulled over their eyes. If we expose this in court, Mr. Hansen, you will become a witness because of what you did, and I will not let you take the witness stand. So the jury ended up confused because Kirikori couldn't explain why the fake data, which was really called the Hansen data, couldn't quite be sorted out. Now, there was a witness by the name of Harrington who wanted to come in and prove that Hansen plagiarized my data, which would explain everything. Hansen refused to call that witness. Hansen refused to present his evidence that showed that. So the public defender knew he was lying. He knew he had thrown the statistician under the bus. The jury didn't know what was going on. The judge had decided and said, and I've got the recording of it because I share it with people in one of my videos, the jury doesn't need to know the whole truth. The wool can be pulled over their eyes. The prosecutors knew that they were lying, and that's a violation not only of judicial ethics, it is a violation of attorney ethics, and for prosecutors, it is a violation of what's called the Brady Rule, which is the federal case, Brady versus Maryland, that says if a prosecutor knows there is evidence of actual innocence, they are obligated to present that. They violated it. Now, this judge has done everything to block my going after him and exposing this. He has blocked my attempts to get the attorneys investigated by the state bar. He personally stopped it. He has blocked every step along the way of this. And then people want to know, well, Fleming, if you're innocent, why did you plead guilty? Okay, I did a plea. Here's why I did the plea.
Well, before you do that, because I feel like I'm a little confused about what the charge was.
Me too.
At the beginning, I mean, something about the number of people in the study. Right. They said that there really weren't 60 people in the study.
Right.
And what was the actual outcome of the study?
The people, 59 of the women lost weight, one gained weight.
And that, and they were trying to say, but wasn't that what they wanted to see? That they lost
weight? But see, those people, what happened is that the FBI turned around and went into my secretary who did the billing. Okay? And they said, Miss Tarasio, we want a case on Dr. Fleming.
And why? Do you have any idea why they were coming after you out of a weight loss study? I mean, that seems like...
Well, they were coming after me originally because of the nuclear imaging stuff.
Wasn't working, so they had to find something else?
Right. And so what they did is they said, Ms. Tarasio, because I walked into the office one day, and when I walked in the office, Vicki was standing at her desk with the telephone, and she looked white as a ghost. And I said, Vicki, what's going on? And she said, that was the FBI. I went, really? She said, they said, I'm either supposed to find something on you or they're going to go back after my husband who's been in prison but is now out of prison, and they're going to put him back in prison.
This was your secretary?
Yep. So my secretary said she didn't see.
They couldn't find anything on the billing study, so they had to come up with something else.
Yeah, and I let them come into my office to copy all the medical records that they wanted. I gave them I shut my practice down. I gave them a day. I gave them my photocopier. Okay, photocopy. Photocopy.
Wow.
Okay. So Vicky said she didn't see 60 people. Now, I had evidence that Vicky wasn't working for me full-time at that time. I had payroll stubs showing she didn't work for me full-time at that time. Would the public defender present that? No, he didn't present that, showing that you can't trust this woman when she says she didn't see 60. Of course she didn't see 60. She was only there half-time.
Wow.
Yeah. So my plea was that I did the study the way I did it. I did a planar and a spec, and I built a 78465, which is exactly what the federal code said I had to build. So I said, my first part of my plea was I build this way, which is the only legal way to build. And then I said there weren't 60 people in the soy chip, in the envelope that I sent off to the soy chip company. And there weren't. There were more, but only 60 that were complete. Now, why did I do that? Because I was going through a divorce, or had gone through a divorce, and my youngest son was being abused and was ending up in the emergency room with head injuries, and he wanted to come live with me. And the only way that was going to happen was if Dr. Fleming said, I'm pleading to something. And they don't even care whether it's a crime. Because the billing, what I said about the billing, was the only legal way to bill. And I never said I made up any soy chip data. I simply said there weren't 60 in the package I sent. True. I mean, I will tell you, I feel kind of, there's that part of me, but that was the best I could come up with to put a statement in there that would make them happy, because there were more than 60, but I didn't say that. Mm. Because they wouldn't have been happy with that. Okay?
So they said you didn't just send 60, and you said that's right. Because, you know, asterisk, footnote, there was actually more than 60.
Yeah. And what I pointed out to the public defender is that had they submitted for the weight of the package, they would have known by the weight of the package that it had to have more than 60 in it. He wouldn't present that. So between the public defender not presenting things, the prosecutors hiding evidence in violation of the Brady rule, and the judge deciding that the jury didn't need to know the truth and the wool could be pulled over their eyes, I got, excuse me, screwed. All because I started off by going, wait a minute, you don't need to give two doses of this isotope, you're lying. Now, I have since published multiple papers showing all this, and I've even taken these images to the people on Twitter that keep attacking me, and I say, okay, then you people match these images up. Here's the 10 images. Here's the 10 5-minute images. Here's the 10 60-minute images. If it doesn't change, you should have no difficulty in matching 10 images up. I took these same 10 images a year and a half, 2 years ago, to the nuclear medicine technology conferences and asked nuclear medicine technologists who spend their life doing nuclear imaging studies and comparing them. One person got three of them right.
Wow.
Most of the people got one or none. Because you can't match images that change.
Right.
And if they change, it means they redistribute. And if they redistribute, it means you only need one dose. And this pharmaceutical company has lied through its teeth and continues to lie through its teeth. So people are, their disease, their heart disease is being missed because the images are being done too late. They're being double radiated. They are being billed for double radiation. And these people are laughing all the way to the bank. And the FDA has kind of said, well, now, and it's now owned by Lantheus Pharmaceuticals. Now, you know, Lantheus says, well, okay, it redistributes some, but we don't know what that means. Well, I'll tell you what it means, folks. There's tons of papers showing what it means. Now, had it not been for all of that, I would not have started being inquisitive and going, wait a minute, something's wrong. Are these images right? I started calibrating the cameras. I started developing the patent. I mean, good news, it led to the only patent that can quantitatively measure changes in tissue. And where we're going right now, I mean, that made it possible to do this study on SARS-CoV-2. So trying to look at the golden part of the cloud, okay? I mean, I'm just... I'm just me, just one man, not that important in reality, you know? I mean, there's tons of important people doing important work out there, okay? I'm trying to, so I'll, look, the good part of that, my son came to live with me. He stopped being abused. I have continued to fight back. I'm continuing to fight for the doctors that are trying to do the right thing for SARS-CoV-2. It has made it possible to find heart disease and breast cancer when people have missed it otherwise, which makes it possible to find the disease earlier, which means we can now try different things. I mean, the people like Dr. William Dooley, who was at Johns Hopkins University, and the protocol for breast cancer at Hopkins is Dooley's, who's now down at the University of Oklahoma, who is 100% behind me on the breast cancer part, because that's his area of expertise, has frequently said, Richard, you know what that means? It means with your test, being able to accurately measure changes in women's and men breast health, we can find disease or changes in the breast before it becomes cancer and do things we never dreamed of. We could do nutritional support. We could do lifestyle support. We could, there's a whole host of things. There's the soy product that we could use that we think has promise that could be used. And women will never need to have breast cancer surgery or radiation if we get it soon enough. So, okay, I'm sorry I teared up. It occasionally happens even to me. But
wait, stop. Two things. One is, first of all, when was this lawsuit? When did all of this happen?
2004. They waited the maximum time that they could wait and then filed the lawsuit while I was helping at a VA in Reno, Nevada. The case was in 2009.
So 2004, it started and it terminated, yep. It concluded with the plea agreement.
Yeah, so the actual case was in 2009. They held this, and one of the things I found out, that they one of the reasons why they came after me, in addition to everything I've said, one of the first things that the public defender told me was, Richard, you're a religious fanatic, and they are coming after you. Now, I don't think of myself as a religious fanatic. In fact, I'm very careful to separate my religious beliefs from my scientific beliefs for two reasons. You need to know that when I'm telling you something scientifically or medically, it's valid. It's not based upon my religious belief. You also need to know that no matter who you are, no matter what your religion is, no matter what race you are, no matter what sex you are, no matter your political party, that when you come to me for treatment or care or research investigation, you are going to get the same treatment as anybody else. I had a good friend, Bob Eckel, who was president of American Heart Association some time ago. And Bob, you can only be president for 1 year. You become elected, then you become the president, then you become past president. You can only be it for 1 year. Bob had trouble because people found out that Bob believed in God. And people tried to block his being president of American Heart because he was a Christian. And Bob said,
why would they do that?
Because some people don't like people who are religious, okay? So Bob said, if you can prove to him where any of his research, which has to do some of the research, same research I do it on diets and nutrition. If you could prove to him where his religious beliefs changed his scientific outcomes, he wouldn't accept president. Well, he became president, okay? But he had to go through that nonsense, all right? So.
Well, let's go back one more time, Richard, because, you know, to make a little bit of a dialogue here. So you've... you know, that the court case, they held back on the... that started in 2004... They actually did the case in 2009. When was it actually terminated? When did you actually conclude it?
2009. Yeah, so they started it on Holy Week of all days.
Oh, that amazing.
Yeah, and my father passed away on Easter Sunday that year.
Wow. So two questions I have out of that. One is, did anything change in terms of the practice of nuclear medicine?
No, because nobody got to hear about it. It has been me pounding the doors to get this message out. And there are people that have an interest, but you know what happens? You know what happens when they say maybe what Fleming has works? They find the court case and they go, you're a felon.
Was it a felony charge?
Yeah, because here's the thing. The difference between what Medicare and Medicaid pays, between the way I billed and the way they wanted it billed, was $50. They pulled 10 cases times $50 equals $500, and you know what that means? Felony. $499 is misdemeanor.
Oh, wow. And so when you plea bargained, you didn't plea bargain away the felony charge?
Oh, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that because they knew that the jury was confused about the soy chip study.
And so the reason that they wanted to hang you out to dry and hang your career out to dry with this felony charge and all the other things that comes along with that on your driver's license, on mortgage payments, on mortgage things that have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Yep.
They wanted to hang you out to dry for life because you were trying to decrease the amount of radiation doses given to humanity and diagnose patients with severe heart disease earlier to save their lives. And that was impacting their bottom line.
Yes, it was. It would be if anybody would take this seriously and look at it, you know.
And so how did that, I mean, because you could see it's still kind of an emotional issue for you. I mean, actually 2009 wasn't that long ago in the big picture of things. I mean, but knowing what you know about decreasing radiation doses in all of humanity, plus all the radiation that gets peed out into the water, you know, we've got all of that. Plus all of those people, I mean, from a human perspective, not just people like you and people like me, we tend to live in our heads, right?
Right.
And we talk about the facts and stuff like that. That had obviously was a major impact, you know, mentally and emotionally too. I mean, where does that lack of moving forward with the knowledge that you have, how do you feel about that?
For many years, it was only in the last couple years that I have mentally gathered and started putting forward to push this forward. You know, I went to law school following that. And you know, one of the first things you learn is that the law is nothing about justice, you know, and what you learn is that these cases are all, decided before you go to court. You know, that, I mean, it's a joke. I mean, I did community service as part of this. One of the things I've learned is that the criminals are actually better at knowing what's real and what's not than the jury. You know, because when I did my community service, because I was determined to prove to myself and the system that I was not going to be broken, I did the crummiest jobs imaginable. I mean, I crawled under houses with gravel on my stomach to pull out water heaters, and I broke up concrete and I chipped ice in the winter so that elderly people could get out of their homes and areas and walk without falling. I did the crummiest jobs I could. And on the last day when I could have left halfway through the day, which would have done my 150 hours, I did the full day because I wasn't going to stop. And what I learned was that the real criminals that were there always asked people why they were having to do community service, what they were guilty of. And what happened, I learned something. When I would tell these criminals, these real criminals, drug dealers, people that had robbed folks, serious crimes, what had gone on, they looked at me and they would go, yeah, we can tell you didn't do anything wrong. You're not a criminal. And then I would listen to them do it with other people. And they would stop them and go, you know, look, just quit lying to us. We know you did it. We know. And so it's like the reality was these people know the difference between people that really do crimes and don't. And I've kind of teased people at times and said, we can just get the justice system we have. You just take away the 12 peers, because let's be honest, I didn't have 12 peers. You know, I mean, they did everything. They select to make sure you don't get real 12 peers. Anybody who might go, wait a minute, no. This does not sound right. This sounds like you people are hiding stuff. Or, you know, this is the way you would bill. In fact, there was a veterinarian who, when they asked her up front, she said, yeah, I know about billing. I know all about billing. She was one of the first people the government said, no, she can't be a juror. It's like, yeah, because she would know what's going on, and she would tell the other people in the jury what you don't want them to know. So, yeah, the criminals really, and just put three criminals in the jury box, and we could just shorten the cases dramatically, because after you present for about 3 or 4 minutes, these people, they know what's going on. They don't buy into the lies. And it's like, wow, we could, you know, anyway, so, yeah.
So how does all, so what does that leave you with emotionally? I mean, in terms of feeling like, you know, I've got all of this information that can make such a difference for humanity, and yet they've like stuffed a sock in my mouth. I mean, what, you know, that's got to like, I know it would weigh on me. I would like, I would probably go through all the phases of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, processing a death, right? Mm-hmm. You go through anger and then bargaining and, you know, all this other stuff before you get to acceptance. But I would probably spend a lot of time being combined somewhere between angry and sad.
Yeah. If I allow it, I could show you an anger that you don't want to see. Hmm. Okay. But that won't help. Okay. Now, I guess that's where I am a religious fanatic. Okay. I firmly believe that this story and what we're doing will get out and make a difference, okay? I don't believe that I was, you know, I went through this garbage. I still got my patented. And I got told by the patent office that the reason why I was having difficulty getting it through was Big Pharma doesn't like these types of patents. But I eventually got through to the patent clerk. And he was shocked. He was like, how did you figure out, okay, who I am, that I'm working? Okay, so I explained to him, and I submitted an in-detail explanation of the patent. And he said, oh my. He says, what type of doctor are you again? I said, well, originally I'm a physicist. And he says, that's all I need to know. He said, I'm an electrical engineer. Electrical engineers and physicists, we write things like nobody else writes them. He says, this looks exactly like what a physicist would write in his explanation of what's going on. He says, your patent works, doesn't it? Your cases work, don't they? You really do have something they don't want. I am going to make sure you get this patent.
Wow.
That's what pushed it through. My knowledge through law school and an honest patent clerk. And so, look, Sherry, this patent, where I'm at right now, fully developed with it, we took the last year to make it useful for SARS-CoV-2. Makes a difference.
What is the patent, or what does it do, I guess?
Okay, so what nuclear cameras, the way they are currently set up to work, aren't accurate. If you ask, you get an image to look at, all right, that image is based upon the information the camera collects. How do you know it's accurate? Everybody presumes it's accurate. And the camera companies have tweaked them with more bells and whistles to make them prettier and have smaller pixels. So you look at that and you go, aha, that's prettier. I can see things I couldn't see before. What you're looking at is an image made by a computer based upon the information it's seeing. But here's part of what I discovered in sorting all this out. The way the cameras are set up, as the pictures become prettier, they lose information. they lose about a third of their information as you make the pictures prettier, which means that what you're looking at isn't valid to begin with. You're only looking at two-thirds of reality, okay? Now, so the first part I did is I figured out how to calibrate the cameras. And that requires an understanding of what isotope are you using? What enhancing agent are you using? What method are you using to increase blood flow? Because heart disease isn't what people think it is. Heart disease is not a narrowed artery, although a narrowed artery is heart disease. Okay, it's just part of it. The arteries of the heart are designed at rest to carry this much blood, okay, through my tube. What the arteries do when you need more blood is the arteries of the heart can do something no other artery can do. They get bigger. And they can carry 5 to 6 times as much blood flow at peak demand as they do at rest.
Wow.
That's flow reserve. That's why you exercise people. You know that stress test? Okay, Bruce of the Bruce Protocol, train Gould, Gould, train me.
Oh, wow.
I've written papers on stress tests. Why did we do stress tests? Because most of the people that we think of as dying from a heart attack are exercising. But we also know that some people have what's called Prince Metals angina or rest angina or variant angina, three names for the same thing, that occurs after they're resting. So, and this doctor, the criminal, has presented at American College of Cardiology conferences the following. We took people, once I had calibrated the cameras, who were laying on a table, comfortable, no chest pain, and we gave them drugs to enhance their blood flow, what I call enhancing agents. The arteries relax and carry more blood flow. That shouldn't cause chest pain, right? You're still laying there, not exercising, you get more blood flow. That doesn't produce angina or chest pain. But now somebody has coronary artery disease. And that is my theory from 1994, that what causes heart disease is inflammation of the walls of the arteries. That's the Fleming inflammation theory of cardiovascular disease. It's the same theory that I explained high blood pressure and cancer and diabetes with, and SARS-CoV-2, because viruses are part of what do that. That's how I knew I was on target. So you take an artery, and in the wall of the artery is where the disease occurs. That's why it's called coronary artery disease, not coronary lumen disease. It's coronary artery disease, the wall. So you take two arteries, and this one is the normal artery, and you say relax with the drugs, and it does this, bigger, right? Take the diseased artery and say relax, and it does this, not as much. What happens? Both of those arteries are getting more blood flow. The person isn't doing any more work. They're laying on the table. They're comfortable. And what happens to them? They get chest pain. It's not a decreased blood flow. It's because the blood flow is different in the different regions of the heart. The diseased artery can't relax as much as the normal artery can. Heart disease is inflammation built up in the walls that impairs the ability of the walls to relax equally. What do our medicines do? Nitroglycerin, beta blockers, those drugs, they relax that diseased artery so it can relax more. What does bypass operation do? It shares good blood flow to bad blood flow areas, so it equalizes the blood flow, so there's no regional blood flow differences. What does laser therapy do? It drills holes to cause new blood vessels to grow, collaterals or neovascularization to share the blood flow. So why does the chest pain go away? The disease doesn't improve in the diseased artery. It's just that there's no discrepancy or regional blood flow differences, because the good one is now sharing with the diseased one. Angina is regional blood flow differences. So what does FMTVDM, my patent, do? It takes a person with whatever camera, we give them a drug that relaxes blood vessels. So wherever there's a blood vessel, we relax it. That increases blood flow. Then we give the isotope. Where does it go? It follows the blood flow. And the isotopes we use get taken up by more metabolically active tissue. So what's more metabolically active than normal? Well, it's a heart that's stressed. That carries more blood flow. It's cancer because cancers are more metabolically active and they grow new blood vessels to themselves so they can eat and nourish and grow. And it's infection and inflammation like SARS-CoV-2 because the white blood cells come in, there's increased blood flow, there's increased metabolic function as the white blood cells are attacking the virus and trying to kill it. You can measure those differences in absolute values once the camera is correctly calibrated. And once it's calibrated, it doesn't matter what that pretty picture looks like. It's the measurements that the camera can tell you using FMT-VDM. So it's no longer a guess of, I think I see, I don't think I see. It is a matter of, what is the regional blood flow and metabolism to the area? And that goes up as you go from dead tissue where there's none, to normal tissue, to inflammation, to infection, to cancers. Now, I wish I could say I was the first one who figured that out, but Gomhurst and Laird about 50 to 75 years ago proposed that would happen for cancer. I just happened to, in the last few years, have done the research to show that that sigmoid curve follows. So all of the things that they have done, all of the beating down of me that they have done, all of the damage that they've done, I have recovered because I have continued to believe that I will be justified in the end, if not in the courts, then by society itself. And you're not the first one to mention a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize for the theory and the Nobel Prize for the patent. I've heard this multiple times from people as they've looked at it. But the patent was used without cost for this study because it is not, when we have a pandemic killing 1.6 million people because of the inflammation and blood clotting that has occurred that has not been treated, I have an obligation to make that patented test available without cost.
Is it available now?
It can be licensed now. Yes, it's available for license now. I've gone away from being generous and just giving it to everybody. In fact, some of the people said, well, now you're just trying to make money. It's like, no. At this point in time, what I'm trying to do is to get you to recognize the three treatments so that people's lives can be saved. After this is said and done, then we'll figure out the dynamics of licensing my patent. But you know what is? What is in the license agreement on this patent? A cap. A cap for how much can be charged for the use of this patent for a test for a patient. Now,
that's nice.
The cap for the heart test, you can get this same test, not quantifying it and using the two injection approach, which is going to miss things, for about $5,000. The cap on this license is 500.
Wow.
Breast cancer. Yeah. So I'm controlling when this goes out, I'm controlling the runaway cost that makes it impossible for patients to receive their tests. Insurance companies can quit bickering about whether they want to pay the bill. They will pay less under the license cap that I have than they would if they went through all the bickering with doctors. So instead of telling patients you have to pay the doctor something, instead of the insurance company playing games with doctors, they simply are going to get a bill. They're going to pay the $350 or the $500, depending upon which test they do. They're going to save money because it's less than they would have negotiated for it anyway. And doctors won't have to wait, and patients won't have to be stressed and worry about whether they're going to lose their homes to the hospital or due to bills.
So, Richard, what you've just gone through here, and we're going to be wrapping it up here in the next few minutes,
right,
is the ultimate taking lemons and making lemonade. I mean, that these people came after you because you were taking all this money out of their pocket and you were trying to do good things for your patients, like I said initially when we started. You were trying to decrease the exposure to radiation. You're trying to diagnose their disease problems earlier so they could get treatment. And they couldn't find anything fraudulent along that. So they had to come up with some fraudulent data issue with a weight loss study.
Right.
And then you, because of things in your family, you copped and plead out. You still had this felony hanging over your head, which is there for life. It's like bubblegum on your shoe. But instead of just kind of going, well, I guess they won, I mean, you proceeded ahead and said, I'm still going to use this brain that God gifted me. I'm still going to use all the education that I've accumulated, both in textbooks and schools and also just clinical stuff, that just life education. And I'm going to proceed to make something a great value for humanity in spite of all of these people, and got this patent to go through because somebody was there, your angel in the patent department said, I'm going to make this happen. And so you're at the point of releasing this back to you, humanity, in spite of all of them. And what an amazing story that is. What a great, great inspirational story that is to everybody that, you know, all of us in our own ways have gone through crap. You know, it may not be nearly to the level of what, you know, you've experienced, but, you know, we've all had stuff. And some people have even had more. I mean, people that have lost limbs and, you know, all different things that have happened. But we all have choices in those losses. We all have choices to just buckle in and fold down and be defeated and get negative and curl up in your hole. But you have, when we realize that this is Earth School, we're spiritual beings here having a physical experience. And part of that, what Earth School is all about is really lessons. And I've long been a believer that, you know, you come down, there's this distinction between free choice and predestination. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that you can have both. I think there can be an element of predestination that when you incarnated under this planet, you had a spark of something that you were coming here to do. And then the free choice is whether or not you're going to do it and the choice of how you're going to respond if things don't go so well. Right. And all of us have episodes in our life of things that didn't go so well. And we can make a choice on what we're going to do with that. And your story, and I'm so grateful that we could put this out there, because it shows the resilience of the human spirit. It shows the brilliance of your mind, your compassion of what you want to do for humanity and your patients to move forward, and that you're just not going to let the bastards get you down, sort of thing. And you exposed all this stuff, and I'm sure that it's going to continue. And so many of these really great stories actually get told kind of after the fact. They kind of get after, did you go away? Are you still there?
I'm still here, but I see my picture dropped.
I don't know what happened. Suddenly that, I don't know what happened.
Hold that thought. I see something here. It says start video. It's I'm not sure what it's doing. Sorry.
I don't know what it's doing either.
Let's see. Well, I've got my name up there. It's just not.
Why is this? The powers that be still don't want to get this story. You know?
Well, maybe it's that the story's gotten there. So, gosh darn it! Start video. Unmute. Okay. Uh-huh. And it's not restarting.
Well, if you keep fiddling with that, I'll keep fiddling with saying what I'm saying as we're wrapping up here is that, you know, this is such just an inspirational story that everybody, I hope, that's listening to this, all of our members, all of our free people that are part of the Tenpenny Files, when you see bits and pieces of this, that you will take to heart and put it into your own context. I mean, this has been a tough year and a tough going forward with so many people. And we've all had our experiences in the distant past, in the recent past, and some things that we're going to be coming up against. And so I think that taking your story, Richard, and what you've been able to do, and what you're going to continue to do ongoing, is just a great inspiration for all of us. I'm so grateful that, you know, I reached out and you said, yes, I want to tell everybody what has happened and what this whole thing is about. Because it's more than just the patent issue. It's more than just, you know, they irrationally and inappropriately named you a felon over $1, essentially, $4.99 versus $500, and did all of these different things that have happened. And I'm so grateful that you're part of our community here and the stuff that you're actually doing, and to be able to share this and get this out to the world, because I think it's a really inspirational and important story.
Well, I appreciate that. It looks like my camera just quit working for whatever reason. So I apologize for that. You just get to see Dr. Richard Fleming.
Well, good. The good news is, for the last hour, we got to see all of you. We got to see you, what you look like. So people are just going to have to look at me here for the next few minutes.
There you go.
So in the last, let's say, 5 minutes or so of what we're doing with our communication, our talk here today, what would be your take-home message that you would like everybody to hear or know about, not only from your whole perspective as a physician, physicist, and lawyer, but just as the human, you know, Dr. Richard Fleming? What's your take-home message as we wind up here?
Well, I think the best take-home message I can tell people is that every day that you get up, independent of anything that's happened to you before, you have decisions that you get to make. And independent of the control that other people think that they have in your life, they can't control that. Your free will is yours to exercise unless you surrender that to somebody else. And that they can't incriminate. That they can't attack. They can't lock it up. They can't imprison it. They can't defame it. It's your free will, and it's your opportunity to make a decision each and every day about whether you're going to make the world a better place or a worse place. And honestly, there are days that I think I will make the patent available to everybody except a specific judge and a few attorneys. But then there's that stupid part of me, that if those same people that knew what they were doing was wrong and still did it were to collapse in front of me, I would still render medical assistance to them, because that's on me, not on them. So I know that 2020 has been hard. I know that there, in so many ways, for everybody. But the reality is that what happens to humanity is dependent upon us and what we decide to do with it, and how we choose to live our lives. And as long as we remember that and trying to make the world a better place in whatever way that we can, then we succeed in that, and these other people cannot take that away from us. And for them, that becomes a true demonstration of just how powerful they are not, and just how powerful you are. And people depend upon you. There's every day you come across people. It is true. You don't know whether they've had a good day, a bad day, whether they've just come off a bad experience. And I firmly believe that we have an obligation to do the very best that we can. And sometimes for me, that means going on the warpath to address what I think are bad people that are causing harm to other people. And I have an obligation to people to at least educate them about the truth so that more people are not harmed. If you don't do something, you are actually doing something. So you have an obligation. You can't stand by idly if you see injustice being done. You can't stand by idly and ask when the cavalry is coming. You are the cavalry.
That's beautiful and so powerful and so accurate. So accurate. I mean, we are the cavalry, and now more than ever at this critical juncture where we are with the human race and humanity and everything that's going on in medicine and healthcare and politics and the vaccine issue and all of the different things that are happening, we are the cavalry. I think we need to have a t-shirt or something that says that, Richard. I think that would be great.
I'll let you come up with that.
All right. Well, on that happy note, I think this was a great interview. Thank you so much for doing this for our members here today and all the things and everything that we've talked about. I thank everybody for being here. Thank you for participating, being part of our membership. There's more to come. We've got a lot more in plan in store for at very high level conversations like this for what we're doing here at the Premium Tenpenny Files. So with that, Richard, thank you so much. And thank you for your time flexibility today. Thank you for everybody that's been listening and staying here with us. We wish you guys have a really good day. And until we see you next time, be safe and be well.
Thank you.